This episode is brought to you by Cert Fuel. They've got a full Series 65 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted just like the real thing. Check it out at CertFuel.com.
Absolutely, check them out.
Yeah, so let's just jump right into it. Welcome to the deep dive. And if you're listening to this right now, I know exactly why you're here. We are on a mission today to completely save your Series 65 exam score.
Oh yeah, we are diving into the deep end of the regulatory pool today.
We really are, because we are dedicating this entire session to the absolute labyrinth that is investment advisor regulation. Who is an IA, who gets to pretend they aren't, who has to register, and you know, how to stay out of regulatory jail.
Which is honestly the foundation of the whole exam. I mean, you literally can't do the job if you don't know this stuff.
Right, but I wanna make a promise to you, the listener, right up front. If you have ADHD like me, or if your brain just completely glazes over when you read a dry textbook, don't worry. This is not going to be a boring lecture.
No, definitely not. We're going to keep it moving.
Exactly. We're going to use ridiculous scenarios. We've got recurring characters. And we are going to explicitly flag every single sneaky gotcha trick that those exam writers love to throw at you.
They do love their tricks.
They really do. So to help us out, I want to quickly introduce our cast of characters for today's deep dive. First up, we've got financial planner Phil.
Oh, Phil.
Yeah, Phil. He's the guy who's always trying to bundle his services together, you know, just to avoid SEC scrutiny. Then we have lawyer Larry.
Classic Larry. Thinks his law degree is just this magical bulletproof shield against securities laws.
Spoiler alert, it is not. And finally, later on, we'll meet billionaire Brenda, whose assets under management, or AUM, are just constantly fluctuating and causing her massive headaches.
She is going to have a rough time with registration, for sure.
But before we torture our characters, let's talk about the why. Because, you know, if you understand why these rules exist, you can logic your way through almost any question. So, why do the regulators care so much?
Well, the Series 65 doesn't just want you to be a memorization machine. They want you to understand that the entire system exists basically to protect investors from fraud.
Right. And conflicts of interest, yeah.
Exactly. Because, I mean, think about the informational disadvantage a regular retail investor has compared to a Wall Street firm. The regulators want all those hidden incentives dragged right out into the light.
They want forced transparency. Like, are you recommending this mutual fund because it's good for my retirement or because the fund manager is, like, secretly buying you a Porsche?
Precisely.
Yeah.
If you keep investor protection in your head, the really tricky exam questions start to just answer themselves.
I love that. Okay, so let's start at the absolute beginning, section one. The IA identity crisis.
The existential question.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Before we even talk about registration paperwork, we have to figure out if a human being even meets the legal definition of an investment advisor. Because if they don't, none of the rules we talk about today even apply to them, right?
Right. You're just completely outside the regulatory net.
Right.
And to figure out if someone is inside the net, the regulators use what's called the three-prong test.
I like to call this the ABC test, just to make it stick in my brain better. A, D, and C. You have to meet all three, right?
Yes, that's a massive point, all three. A is for advice, B is for business, C is for compensation.
Okay, let's break them down mechanically. Starting with A, advice. Does this person provide advice or reports or analysis concerning securities? But advice feels like a really slippery word.
It is, and the regulators cast a very wide net here.
So, like, if I'm at a barbecue and I tell my buddy, hey, the tech sector looks awful right now, I wouldn't touch it. Is that advice? I didn't tell him what to buy.
It absolutely is.
Yeah.
Making a specific recommendation to buy a stock is advice, but telling someone not to buy a stock is also advice.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Even just evaluating someone's portfolio or giving them a general asset allocation model, like telling them to be 60% equities and 40% bonds, that counts as advice concerning securities. You check the A box.
Okay. So the A box is super easy to accidentally check. Let's look at B, business. Are you in the business of providing this advice?
Yeah, this one filters out the loudmouth uncle at Thanksgiving. The regulators are looking for regularity. Do you hold yourself out to the public as doing this?
But wait, does it have to be my full-time job? Like, what if I walk dogs 40 hours a week, but every Saturday I charge people to review their stock portfolios?
You're still in the business. It doesn't have to be your principal activity. It just has to be a regular commercial thing you do.
Got it. Okay. Which brings us to C, compensation. And this is the one that destroys people on the exam.
Oh, it really is. Because when you say compensation, most people just picture a client handing you a check.
Right. But the definition is way broader than that. Let's bring in financial planner Phil to test this.
Let's do it.
Okay, so Phil sits down with a new client. He's big on holistic planning. He builds this gorgeous 100-page leather-bound financial plan. It's got budgeting, life insurance, mortgage stuff, estate taxes.
A real masterpiece.
A masterpiece. But on page 98, right at the back, he has a tiny section recommending the client move their 401k into three specific mutual funds.
Ah, there it is.
Phil's going to tell the SEC, hey, I'm a financial planner. My main business is insurance and budgeting. That mutual fund stuff is just a tiny fraction of the plan, so I'm not an investment advisor. How does the SEC view Phil's argument?
They view it as complete garbage, honestly.
Really?
Yeah, the SEC actually issued a specific document release, IA 10092, because so many financial planners were trying to use that exact excuse. The SEC said very clearly that if securities advice is just a component of a financial plan, it counts.
So there's no percentage limit? Like, it doesn't matter if it's only 1% of the binder?
Nope, no percentage threshold at all. You give the advice as part of the plan, you check the A box.
Okay, so Phil meets A for advice and B for business. Now let's talk about C. Listener, I want you to actively think about this next part. Put yourself in the test center.
Get ready.
Phil gives the client the binder, but Phil decides not to charge the client a single dime for the plan. It's totally free.
Generous guy.
Right. The client leaves without paying. But UT, when the client goes home and actually buys those three mutual funds from page 98, the mutual fund company quietly pays Phil a referral fee on the back end.
Interesting.
So, listener, here is your direct question. Does Phil meet the compensation prong? Take a beat. Think about it.
Take a second.
What's the verdict? Does he meet it?
The verdict is unequivocally yes. Phil has been compensated.
But the client didn't pay him. I can hear people yelling that right now.
I know, and that is the exam trap right there. The law does not care who writes the check. It only cares that Phil received an economic benefit for giving the advice.
A direct or indirect.
Exactly. Direct fees, third-party commissions, finder's fees, or even something called soft dollars.
Oh, soft dollars. We need to touch on that because it sounds so shady. What actually are soft dollars?
It sounds like mob slang, but it's a real arrangement. Basically, an advisor gets free services from a broker-dealer in exchange for routing their client's trades to that broker.
So, like, if Phil needs a really expensive portfolio software that costs 20 grand a year.
Right, the broker-dealer might say, "Hey, run all your trades through us. We'll generate commissions off your clients, and we will buy that 20 grand software for you for free."
Wow. So Phil didn't get cash, but he got a $20,000 benefit.
Yep, soft dollars. And it absolutely counts as compensation. So, Phil, it was officially trapped by the ABC test. He is an investment advisor.
Exam trap flag right here, folks.
Yeah.
Missing one prong means you are not an IA, but compensation does not have to come directly from the client. Don't fall for it.
Very true.
Okay, so Phil is trapped, but what if you meet the ABC test, but the law just decides to let you off the hook anyway? That brings us to section two, exclusions.
The get out of registration free cards.
Exactly. And let's be super precise here with our vocabulary. If you are excluded, it means you are completely outside the definition of an IA. You don't register, you don't file forms, you just aren't an IA. So who gets this magical pass?
The most tested group is an acronym, LATE, lawyers, accountants, teachers, and engineers.
Okay, let's bring in lawyer Larry because Larry is about to make a huge mistake.
Larry's always getting into trouble.
He really is. So Larry is a successful estate attorney. He's sitting with a client, drafting a trust, and he says, "You know, to fund this trust properly, you really need to sell your Apple stock and buy some municipal bonds."
Okay, so he just gave securities advice.
Right. And it's his business, and he's charging $500 an hour, so he's getting compensated. He meets the ABC test, but he's a lawyer. Doesn't his LATE card protect him here?
It does protect him in this specific moment. But it's vital to know why. It protects him because the advice is, quote, solely incidental to his legal practice.
Solely incidental. Let's build a metaphor for that. Think of Larry's law practice as a giant engine.
Okay, I like that.
The engine's job is to make legal documents. But when you run a big engine, it naturally produces exhaust fumes. You can't avoid it.
Right, the exhaust.
So if you're drafting a trust, the natural byproduct, the exhaust, is that you have to talk about the assets going into the trust. As long as the financial advice is just exhaust, it's solely incidental.
That's a great way to visualize it, but
okay, then Larry decides to get fancy. He orders heavy stock business cards that say Larry's Law and Financial Planning. He hands one to a client. What happens to his exclusion?
It goes up in flames because he just tried to bottle the exhaust and sell it as a separate product.
Huh. Yes.
The moment he advertises financial planning as a distinct service, It is no longer solely incidental. He loses the LATE exclusion immediately, and since he's unregistered, he's operating illegally.
So the title of lawyer isn't a magic shield. It's about how you act.
Exactly.
Okay, what about broker-dealers? Because Wall Street brokers give stock advice literally all day long. Are they excluded?
They are, but with two huge conditions. First, just like Larry, the advice has to be solely incidental to their main job of executing trades.
Okay, so the advice is just the exhaust of the trading engine. What's the second condition?
This is the big one. They cannot receive any special compensation for the advice.
We really need to compare this side by side. The old way versus the new way, like standard commissions versus wrap fees. Because if you don't understand wrap fees, you're going to fail this section.
Oh, for sure. So the old standard model. A broker pitches a stock, the client buys it, the broker charges a standard $50 trading commission.
And the regulators say that $50 is for executing the trade, not for the advice, right?
Right. No special compensation, the exclusion holds, but...
But Wall Street evolved. They realized clients hated paying $50 every single time they bought a stock. It felt like they were getting nickeled and dimed.
And it incentivized brokers to just churn accounts to generate more commissions.
Exactly. So the broker dealers say, let's bundle it. We'll give you unlimited advice, portfolio management, and all your trades for one flat fee, like 1.5% of your assets per year. This is the wrap fee.
And wrap fees are wildly popular. But the moment a broker dealer charges a wrap fee, they violate the no special compensation rule.
Wait, really? Even though they're still doing the trades?
Yeah, because the wrap fee explicitly charges for the advisory service as part of the bundle. So any broker-dealer offering a wrap fee instantly loses their exclusion. They have to register as an investment advisor.
Exam trap flag right there. Wrap fee equals IA. Every time. Okay, next exclusion. Publishers. Newspapers, financial magazines.
Yeah, this is where it gets into First Amendment territory.
Right. If a huge newspaper prints a headline saying, sell all tech stocks now, they just gave advice to a million people, are they an IA?
Generally, no. They have a publisher's exclusion. The publication just has to be regular, bona fide news, and here's the key for the exam. The advice must be general and non-tailored.
Let's test this with a scenario. If I pay $100 for a monthly newsletter that tells all 50,000 subscribers to buy gold, the publisher is safe, right?
Perfectly safe.
Yeah.
Excluded.
But what if I pay $1,000 for their platinum tier? I fill out a questionnaire about my age and risk tolerance, and the publisher emails me a customized portfolio just for my retirement. What happens to their First Amendment protection?
It is gone. The moment they cross from a general broadcast into personalized, customized advice, they lose the publisher exclusion. They are now an investment advisor.
General keeps you safe. Tailored gets you regulated. Love that. Okay, what about banks?
Banks are simple, but watch out for the geography trap. The exclusion only applies to domestic U.S. banks.
So if a massive Swiss bank opens a branch in Chicago and gives investment advice, does their foreign charter protect them?
Nope. Foreign banks do not get the exclusion. U.S. regulators don't have enough insight into foreign bank operations, so they force them to register.
Got it. Domestic only. Last exclusion. Federal-only government securities advisors.
This is a niche one. If you give advice solely on U.S. government securities, like treasury bonds, you are excluded under federal law. The SEC doesn't care.
Wait, another exam trap flag here. You said federal law. What about state law under the Uniform Securities Act?
Exactly. The states do not recognize this exclusion. So you might be totally exempt from the SEC, but your state administrator will absolutely make you register locally.
Wow. Okay. Take a breath. We just covered a lot. We defined who is an IA with the ABC test, and we talked about who gets completely excluded from that definition. If you're excluded, you're not an IA. End of story.
Right. But what if you aren't excluded?
Yeah. What if your financial planner failed? You meet the ABC test, you don't have a law degree, you're not a bank, you are officially an investment advisor.
Welcome to the club.
This brings us to section 3, excluded versus exempt, and the paperwork purgatory. And hey, listener, are you zoning out? Seriously, snap back to me, because mixing up these next two words will absolutely cost you points on test day.
It is the number one reason people fail this section.
Let's build a mental model. Picture a giant box labeled investment advisors. If you are excluded, where are you? You are completely outside the box. You aren't an IA. Right. But if you are exempt, you are inside the box. You are an IA. But you just get a special permission slip to skip the registration paperwork. You don't have to register right now.
Exactly. Excluded means not an IA. Exempt means you are an IA, but you're skipping the line.
So who gets this magical permission slip? Let's talk state level first. the de minimis exemption.
Right. De minimis essentially means too small to care about. The state regulators don't want to waste resources tracking down tiny operations.
But they have very strict mechanical rules for what counts as too small, right?
Very strict. To qualify for de minimis in a state, you must have N, no place of business in that state, and D, you must have 5 or fewer retail clients in that state over the last 12 months.
Okay, let's stress test this. I want you to listen closely to this one, listener. Financial planner Phil lives and is registered in New York. He has 0 clients in Texas, literally 0.
Okay.
But Phil wants to look like a big national firm. So he rents a tiny, empty 100 square foot office in Austin, Texas, just so he can put an Austin mailing address on his glossy brochures.
Ah, I see where this is going.
He has 0 clients in Texas. 0 is definitely fewer than 5. Listener, ask yourself, does Phil qualify for the de minimis exemption in Texas?
Give him a beat.
Think about it. Does he?
The answer is no. His exemption is completely dead.
But why? He has 0 clients there.
Because the rule is 5 or fewer clients, and no place of business. The and is everything. The moment he signs a lease and puts that address on a brochure, he has a place of business. The state administrator says, if you have a footprint here, you register here.
The office is fatal to the exemption, even with 0 clients. Okay, let's flip it. Let's take the office away. Phil shuts down the Austin office. He has no physical presence in Texas.
Okay, back to 0 footprint.
But Phil gets really famous, and he starts managing money for 20 massive, multi-billion dollar institutional pension funds located in Texas.
Lies for Phil.
Right. But wait, 20 clients is way more than 5. Did Phil just blow past the cap and trigger registration?
No, he didn't. He is perfectly exempt.
Why? 20 is greater than 5.
Because the rule specifically counts retail clients. Everyday people. Institutional clients like massive pension funds or banks do not count toward the 5 client cap.
Exam trap. Institutional clients don't count.
Exactly. The laws are meant to protect vulnerable retail investors. Regulators assume a billion-dollar pension fund has its own lawyers to protect it. So Phil can have 100 institutional clients in Texas, and as long as he has no office and 5 or fewer retail clients, he's exempt.
Makes total sense. Okay, that's the state level. What about the SEC level? They have something called an ERA, an exempt reporting advisor.
Yeah, the ERA was created after the 2008 financial crisis. The SEC wanted to monitor private funds like hedge funds and venture capital, but they didn't want to bury them in full registration paperwork.
So it's a compromise. You're exempt from full registration, but you still have to report to the SEC by filing a partial form ADV.
Right. You're giving them basic demographic data so they can monitor systemic risk.
Now, the exam loves to compare private fund ERAs side by side with venture capital ERAs. What's the difference?
It comes down to AUM, assets under management. A private fund ERA, which usually means a hedge fund, has a hard cap of $150 million.
So if a hedge fund hits $151 million.
The SEC says they are too big and too risky to be partially exempt. They must fully register.
Okay, what about venture capital ERAs?
Venture capital ERAs have no AUM cap at all. They could manage $10 billion and still just be an ERA.
That seems crazy unfair. Why do VC funds get a massive hall pass?
Because of the economic function of the money. Venture capital funds startups and creates jobs. The government likes that. Plus, VC money is locked up for a decade. They aren't day trading the market, so the systemic risk of a sudden collapse is much lower.
So hedge funds trade fast and use leverage, so they get capped at $150 million. VC funds build startups long term, so they get unlimited runway. That logic helps so much.
It really does.
Okay, before we leave this section on exclusions and exemptions, we need to address what I call the ultimate truth.
Oh, this is the big one.
Listener, if you forget everything else, remember this. We have excluded people like Lawyer Larry. We have exempt people like Phil with his 3 Texas clients. We have ERAs and fully registered IAs. Is there one rule that applies to every single one of them?
Yes. The anti-fraud provisions.
Say it louder for the people in the back.
Nobody gets a free pass to commit fraud. It doesn't matter if you're a perfectly excluded newspaper publisher or a massive VC fund. The exemptions only apply to the paperwork.
Exactly. Exempt from registration does not mean exempt from oversight. If you lie, cheat, or steal, the state administrator will still throw you in jail.
Paperwork status is irrelevant when it comes to fraud.
Brilliant. Okay. Section 4, the AUM tug of war. Let's say you are an IA, you have no exclusions, no exemptions, you are completely cornered and you have to register.
Time to face the music.
But who is your boss? Do you register with your local state administrator or do you register with the SEC in Washington, D.C.?
This is a classic turf war. And it was solved in 1996 by a law called NSMIA. They divided the pie based on size. Small goes to the states, big goes to the federal government.
So size is measured in AUM, assets under management. Let's lay out the exact thresholds.
Under $25 million in AUM, you are a small advisor. You must register with the state. You're actually legally prohibited from going to the SEC.
Okay, next tier. $25 million to $100 million.
Mid-size advisors. Generally, you still must register with the state. There are tiny, obscure exceptions, but for the exam, assume this is state jurisdiction.
Now we hit the fun zone. $100 million to $110 million.
This is the transition zone. Once you cross $100 million, you unlock a choice. You are eligible to register with the SEC, but you don't have to. You can stay with the state if you want.
And the ceiling, $110 million and above.
Mandatory. The choice is gone. At $110 million, you are a federal covered advisor and you must register with the SEC.
Okay, let's bring in our final character, billionaire Brenda, to stress test this.
Oh boy, Brenda's AUM roller coaster.
Yep.
Brenda starts the year with $90 million in AUM. She's mid-sized, so she is registered with her state. But then she has a massive year. The market booms, she signs new clients, and her AUM skyrockets to $111 million.
So she crossed the mandatory threshold. She has to do the grueling paperwork, deregister from the state, and register with the SEC.
Right. She reprints all her brochures, becomes federal covered. But UT, a month later, a geopolitical crisis tanks the stock market. Her clients panic, they pull money out, and overnight her AUM plummets back down to $105 million.
Ouch.
Let's pause and look at this horror show. She is sitting at $105 million. The mandatory SEC line is $110 million.
Mm-hmm.
Does Brenda have to immediately pack her bags, deregister from the SEC, and go crawling back to the state?
She absolutely does not, and thank goodness, because this is where the buffer zone comes in.
Explain the daily reality of why we need a buffer zone between $90 million and $110 million. Why not just one hard line at $100 million?
Yeah.
Because of regulatory whiplash. If the line was exactly $100 million, Brenda could be SEC on Monday. The market drops 2% on Tuesday, so she has to switch to the state. And then it rallies on Wednesday, so she has to switch back to the SEC.
Her compliance officer would literally jump out a window.
They would spend 100% of their time filing forms. So the buffer zone makes it asymmetrical. The door to get into the SEC is $110 million. But the trap door to get kicked out of the SEC isn't until you fall all the way below $90 million.
That is such a vital visual. So at $105 million, Brenda is perfectly safe. She stays with the SEC.
Yep. The market can bounce between 91 and 120 all year, and her registration never changes.
Okay, what about the timelines? If she does hit $110 million, does she have to be registered with the SEC by 9 a.m. the next morning?
No, there are grace periods. If a state advisor grows and hits $110 million, they have 90 days to register with the SEC.
And if an SEC advisor shrinks below $90 million,
they get 180 days to register with the states.
Wait, why is the downgrade timeline twice as long? 180 days down, but only 90 days up.
Logistical nightmare. Going up means filing one form with one federal agency. Going down means losing your federal shield and having to figure out the specific quirky rules for maybe 15 different individual states all at once. That Wow. takes way more time, so they give you a full 6 months.
Okay, here is a massive exam scenario to test the exceptions. Is there any type of IA who is federal covered SEC registered, regardless of their AUM? Like, if they only have $5 million, can they bypass the state?
Yes. An advisor to a registered investment company, basically a mutual fund or an ETF.
The exam will totally bait you on this. They'll say, Advisor X manages a new mutual fund with only $12 million in AUM. Where do they register?
And everyone sees $12 million, thinks of the $25 million threshold, and clicks state, and they fail the question.
Because the nature of the product overrides the AUM. Mutual funds are national products. They go straight to the SEC. Mutual fund equals SEC.
Every time.
One last mechanical detail here. When does the registration actually become official? Say Brenda files her SEC paperwork on July 1st. Can she start charging clients on July 2nd?
Nope. There's a waiting period. If you register with the state, it becomes effective at noon on the 30th day after filing.
Noon on the 30th day.
Yeah. And if you register with the SEC, it's effective on the 45th day.
Why noon for the state? It's so oddly specific.
Just a historical quirk from the old days of mail processing. But because it's weird, exam writers love to test it. State registration, noon on the 30th day.
All right, section 5, notice filing. The state's CC me rule. So Brenda is massive. She is federal covered. She only registers with the SEC. But her corporate headquarters is a giant skyscraper in downtown Los Angeles.
Beautiful building.
Does California just ignore her? They pretend she doesn't exist.
Oh, California absolutely wants their cut.
Yeah.
and they get it through notice filing.
Break this down mechanically because it sounds like she's dual registered.
It is not dual registration.
Yeah.
Notice filing is just a requirement for federal covered advisors to notify a state that they are operating there. You have to notice file if you meet either of two conditions.
What are they?
Condition one, you have a place of business in that state. Condition two, you have six or more retail clients in that state.
So Brenda has an office in LA. She notice files in California. If she has no office in Nevada, but 12 clients in Vegas, she notice files in Nevada.
Exactly.
I love visualizing this as a highway toll booth. Listener, imagine you're driving an 18-wheeler across the country. You have a federal commercial driver's license. The state of Ohio cannot pull you over and demand you rebuild your engine.
Right. The truck's design is federally regulated.
But when you drive that truck onto the Ohio Turnpike, Ohio will absolutely make you stop at a toll booth and pay a fee to use their roads. That's notice filing.
That's a perfect analogy.
So what paperwork is Brenda handing at the window at this toll booth?
Three things. First, a copy of her Form ADV, the exact same one she sent the SEC. She's just CCing the state. Second, a consent to service of process.
Oh, what's that?
It's a legal doc that basically says, if a client in your state sues me, I acknowledge your courts have jurisdiction, and you can serve subpoenas directly to the administrator for me.
And the third thing?
The most important thing to the state, a check to pay the state filing fee.
She pays the toll. Now, listen closely, listener. Exam trap incoming.
Here it comes.
Brenda is federal covered. She opens a Dallas office, submits her Form ADV, signs the consent, and pays a $300 fee to the Texas administrator. Has Brenda registered in Texas?
Yes. The answer is false. Notice filing is not registration.
Yeah.
Texas cannot tell Brenda how to run her compliance program or demand higher net worth minimums. They just collect the fee and put her in a filing cabinet.
But wait, what if the truck driver starts intentionally running cars off the road? What if Brenda starts running a Ponzi scheme in Texas?
Remember the ultimate truth. Texas can't regulate her daily operations, but they absolutely retain their anti-fraud authority. If she steals, Texas will prosecute her.
Notice filing just makes sure the state knows she's in their backyard so they can keep an eye out for fraud. Got it. Okay, section six, keeping the lights on.
The never-ending treadmill of paperwork.
Exactly. We have to keep the regulators happy. Let's talk about the master blueprint of the firm, the Form ADV. It's broken into parts, and the exam wants you to know what goes where.
So part one is the regulatory filing, the dry, factual background check, ownership structure, AUM, disciplinary history. This is for the regulators and their computer systems. Retail clients will almost never read part one.
Okay, part one is for computers. What about part two?
Part two is the heart of the client relationship, and it's split into 2A and 2B.
What's 2A?
Part 2A is the firm brochure. This is client-facing. It has to be written in plain English, no dense legalese. It explains the firm's services, fees, and conflicts of interest.
So 2A is the story of the firm. What is 2B?
Part 2B is the brochure supplement. Think of 2A as the corporate entity and 2B as the specific human being sitting across the desk from you.
The IAR.
Exactly. The individual representative. Mm. 2B have their educational background, business experience, disciplinary history, and any outside business activities, like if they sell real estate on the side.
2A is the firm. 2B is the human. And what about part three? Form CRS.
Form CRS is the client relationship summary. It's a new, highly condensed, strictly formatted, two-page summary only for retail investors. Because, honestly, nobody was reading the 50-page brochures. This lets a client put two firms side by side on their kitchen table and compare fees instantly.
Let's focus on delivering that Part 2A brochure. This is a massive compliance hurdle. What are the mechanical delivery rules for a new client?
You have two options under state rules. Option one, you deliver the brochure at least 48 hours before they sign the contract.
Yeah.
Option two, you deliver it at the exact time of signing, but the contract must include a legal provision giving the client the right to cancel without penalty within 5 business days.
Let's look at the psychology here. Why 48 hours early or a 5-day escape hatch? What evil behavior are they trying to stop?
Boiler room sales tactics. High pressure manipulation. They don't want a smooth talking advisor locking an elderly client in a room, hyping them up, handing them a 50-page brochure, and pressuring them to sign immediately.
So it's a forced cooling off period. You either give them 2 days to read it at home before signing, or if you force a one meeting close, they get 5 days of buyer's remorse to tear up the contract for free.
Exactly. 48 hours before or 5 days to cancel.
What about record keeping? We're generating mountains of trade tickets and contracts. When can we legally shred it all?
Investment advisors must keep their books and records for 5 years.
5 years. And where?
For the first 2 years, they must be kept at the firm's principal office and be readily accessible. The regulator wants to be able to walk in unannounced and say, "Show me last year's trades right now." After 2 years, you can move them off-site, but you keep them for the full five.
Exam trap alert. If you're studying for the Series 65, you probably also learned the rules for broker-dealers. Do BDs have the same five-year rule?
No, they do not. BDs generally have a three-year record retention rule. IAs have 5 years. Do not mix those up.
IA equals 5, BD equals 3. Okay, updating the Form 80V. The business changes over time. When are the deadlines?
Two specific annual deadlines. First, file an annual updating amendment with the regulators within 90 days of the end of the firm's fiscal year.
90 days for the government.
Second, deliver an updated brochure to all existing clients within 120 days of the fiscal year end.
Why does the client get it 30 days later?
Just logistics. The firm finalizes the data, files it, gets it approved, and then they have 30 days to physically mail it or email it to thousands of retail clients.
90 for the state, 120 for the client. Got it. Now, what about the individuals? Continuing education.
CE is huge.
Let's bring lawyer Larry back. Larry fully registered as an IAR. The rule says he needs 12 continuing education credits every year. Now, Larry loves ethics. He's a lawyer. But he hates learning about new investment products. He finds crypto and leveraged ETFs boring. Listener, direct question for you. Can Larry just take 12 hours of ethics courses to satisfy his CE requirement?
Take a second.
Think about the regulator's goal.
The answer is no. He absolutely can.
Now regulators love ethics.
They do, but they also demand competence. The 12 credits must be strictly split. 6 credits on products and practice, and 6 credits on ethics and professional responsibility.
So a mandatory 6 and 6 split, no mixing and matching.
Right. Larry has to suffer through the product training so he doesn't put a client into something he doesn't understand.
Okay, we are heading into the deep end now. Section 7, supervision and bad behavior. Why do all these rules actually exist? It's to catch people doing sketchy things with client money.
Yes. Firms have a strict duty to supervise their employees. They must have written compliance policies and designate a chief compliance officer, a CCO, to enforce them.
And one of the strictest rules is that the firm must monitor the personal securities transactions of all its supervised persons. Like, the CCO has to see my personal brokerage account where I trade my own money. Why?
Because the personal account is where conflicts of interest become actual crimes. Monitoring personal trades is the only way a firm can catch the two most heavily tested crimes, front-running and scalping.
Let's deep dive into the mechanics of these two, because they sound similar but operate very differently. Paint a picture of a front-running trade.
Front-running is basically a race based on insider knowledge. Say you're an advisor managing money for a massive pension fund. The fund says, buy us 500,000 shares of XYZ microcap tech.
That's a huge block trade for a tiny stock.
Exactly. When you execute that trade, the massive demand will drive the stock price straight up. As the advisor, you hold this secret knowledge. So before you execute the client's trade, you quickly log into your personal account and buy 2,000 shares for yourself at the low price.
You run in front of the client's order, you steal the momentum.
Yep. Then you execute the client's massive block trade. The stock price spikes 10%. You immediately sell your personal shares into that spike for a risk-free profit.
And the client actually gets a slightly worse average price because your personal buy started moving the market early. That is insidious.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what about scalping?
Scalping is more like a pump and dump driven by influence. In scalping, the advisor already owns cheap shares in their personal account. Then they use their platform, like a newsletter or an urgent email blast to all their clients saying, XYZ is the next Amazon. Buy now.
So the trusting retail clients rush in and start buying, creating artificial demand.
Right. The price pumps up. The advisor quietly sells their personal shares at the top, scalping the profit. When the artificial demand dies, the price crashes, leaving the clients holding the bag.
Front running exploits an impending block trade. Scalping artificially pumps a stock you already own. Both are deeply illegal. And both can only be caught if the CCO is aggressively comparing the firm's trading blotter with the personal trading blotters.
Which leads to a massive liability concept. Failure to supervise.
Okay, scenario time. A rogue IIR gets caught scalping, the state swoops in, the CCO throws their hands up and says, I didn't know, we have a flawless 300-page compliance manual right here on the shelf that explicitly says, do not scalp. We told him not to. Does the firm get off the hook?
Absolutely not. I didn't know is not a valid defense. Having a beautiful manual on a dusty shelf is necessary, but it is not sufficient. You must actively enforce it.
So if the CCO was collecting the personal trade statements but never actually reading them or running them through software, the firm is liable.
Yes. Ignorance born of negligence is still liability.
Take the blindfold off. Got it. Okay, final stretch. Section 8. Financial requirements. Show me the money.
Regulators want to make sure advisors aren't secretly broke and disparate because desperate people steal.
Right. So states impose minimum net worth requirements, but it scales based on the level of control the advisor has. Let's do a side by side. Custody versus discretion versus neither.
Custody is the most dangerous. Custody means you literally hold the client's money and securities. You have physical or systemic access. Like, you can wire the money to the Bahamas.
Because the risk of outright theft is so high, what's the net worth requirement?
$35,000 at all times.
$35,000 for custody. What about discretion?
Discretion means you have the legal power to make trades without asking permission first. You just buy the stock. But the assets are held at a third-party qualified custodian, like Schwab or Fidelity. You can tell Schwab to trade, but you cannot withdraw the cash into your personal checking account.
I have a metaphor for this. Custody is like the client parking their car inside your personal locked garage at your house. You possess the vehicle. The state says you need a bigger insurance policy for that. $35,000 for the garage.
Right. And discretion.
Discretion is like the client just handing you the keys. You can drive the car around, make the driving decisions, but you don't own the car and you can't sell it to a chop shop.
That's a perfect structural analogy because you just have the keys. The risk is lower. So the minimum net worth for discretion is only $10,000.
$35,000 for the garage, $10 for the keys. And what if you have neither? You just give advice and the client makes their own trades.
The requirement is $0. You can be broke and still give advice as long as you can't touch the money or make trades.
Exam writers love testing those numbers in tricky scenarios, so read carefully and find out if they have the keys or the garage.
Exactly.
Okay, we have covered an absolute mountain of regulatory mechanics today. We're going to bring it all home with a rapid-fire recap of the top testable takeaways. I'm going to throw the concept at you. You hit me with the mechanical rule. Ready?
Let's do it.
The three-prong test for an IA.
ABC. Advice, business, compensation. Meet all three, you're an IA. Miss one, you're not.
Does compensation have to be a direct check?
No. Indirect, third-party referrals, and soft dollars all count.
The LATE exclusion? Lawyers, accountants, teachers, engineers. The operational test.
Advice must be solely incidental. The exhaust fumes. If you advertise financial planning, you lose the exclusion instantly.
Broker-dealers. When do they lose their exclusion?
When they charge special compensation, which almost always means a wrap fee. Wrap fee equals IA.
The de minimis exemption for state registration. The two criteria.
No place of business in the state. A&D 5 or fewer retail clients in the preceding 12 months. Institutional clients do not count.
Federal SEC registration. Mandatory threshold.
$110 million in AUM.
The buffer zone to deregister from the SEC.
Once you hit $110 million, you stay with the SEC until your AUM drops all the way below $90 million. Prevents regulatory whiplash.
An advisor managing a mutual fund.
Always federal. Covered with the SEC no matter how small they are.
Notice filing. Is it dual registration?
No, it's a toll booth fee. File the ADV, sign consent, pay the fee, but the state can't regulate your daily operations.
Record keeping rules for an IA.
5 years total, first two at the principal office. Don't confuse it with the broker-dealer 3-year rule.
Minimum net worth requirement.
$35,000 for custody, the garage, $10,000 for discretion, the keys, $0 for neither.
And the ultimate truth that applies to literally everyone we talked about today.
The anti-fraud provisions. Nobody gets a free pass to commit fraud.
Brilliant. We made it through the muddy waters. But I want to leave you, the listener, with one final provocative thought to chew on as you finish your study session.
Oh, this is a good one.
We just definitively established that anti-fraud rules apply to everyone, even the perfectly excluded folks. Think about that newspaper publisher we talked about, the one who sends out a general newsletter to 50,000 people. Under the law, they are excluded. They aren't an IA.
Right. They never file a Form ADV. They never notice file.
They never pay a registration fee. They are completely invisible to the regulatory database. But legally, they are still subject to the anti-fraud provisions. If that publisher is secretly scalping the stock they're recommending, they're committing a massive crime.
A huge crime.
So here is the question to ponder. If they never file a single piece of paperwork, if they never have to submit to an audit from a CCO and their name isn't in any state registry, how does the state administrator actually catch them doing it?
That's a great question.
If the entire regulatory system is built on tracking paperwork and conducting audits,
How do you police the ghosts who are legally allowed to skip the paperwork entirely? It's a fascinating, dangerous crack in the regulatory armor, and it's where some of the biggest financial crimes in history take place. Keep your eyes open out there, study the mechanics of why these rules exist, and good luck on the exam.